Sunset is an angel weeping, holding out a bloody sword. No matter how I squint, I cannot make out what it's pointing toward. Sometimes you feel yourself pacing the cage.
You're listening to The Drew Marshall Show, Canada's most listened to spiritual talkback program.
I've proven who I am so many times.
Well, folks, I think I have the longest bio of any person I've ever had on the show, but it's going to be well worth it. Listen to this. For 35 years, Ravi Zacharias has spoken all over the world and in numerous universities, notably Harvard, Princeton, Oxford. He's addressed writers of the Peace Accord in South Africa, the President's Cabinet and Parliament in Peru, and military officers at the Lenin Military Academy and the Center for the Geopolitical Strategy in Moscow. At the invitation of the President of Nigeria, he addressed delegates at the first annual prayer breakfast for African leaders held in Mozambique. He has twice spoken at the annual prayer breakfast at the United Nations in New York, which marks the beginning of the UN General Assembly each year. As the 2008 honorary chairman of the National Day of Prayer, he gave addresses at the White House, the Pentagon, and the Cannon House. Dr. Zacharias has been a visiting scholar at Cambridge University, where he studied moralists, philosophers, and literature of the Romantic era, and is well-versed in the disciplines of comparative religions, cults, and philosophy. He is presently visiting lecturer at Wycliffe Hall, Oxford University in Oxford, England. RZIM is the website, rzim.org. Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. Many of you are tuning in right now just to hear this gentleman, and I'm going to try to provide you the most unique Ravi Zacharias interview you've ever had. Maybe better than Kirk Cameron's interview, I hope. How are you doing, Ravi?
I'm doing well, Drew. How are you doing?
Great. I'm out of breath, though. Seriously, that was just a huge... You better live up to that.
Well, I tell you what, sometimes when I listen to that myself, I wonder if they're talking about me, but... All things aside, it's been a busy life, and even as I'm talking to you, literally packing away and heading for a trip to Singapore, Malaysia, and India tomorrow. So travel's been the hazard of my trade, but it's been a privilege to be serving God in this particular calling, and it's taken a toll on my back, and physically it's strenuous, but it's wonderful to go across cultures and meet some of the finest people in the world.
Well, born in Madras, raised in Delhi, your ancestors were of the highest order of Hindu priests, but you were told by your father, who worked for the Indian government, that you were an embarrassment to the family and going to be a complete failure. You even failed at suicide.
Yes, sir, and in fact, within the range of your voice, probably are my two sisters. She is the wife of a pastor in Toronto, and my other sister in St. Catharines, Ontario. The latter is a teacher, the first one, the wife of a pastor, as I said. I come from a family of five, Drew, and, my dad was right, the way I was headed, and, in fact, almost fulfilled what he talked about. Totally undisciplined, no application of any kind, no motivation. I've told my story in the book, Walking from East to West. I loved cricket, wanted to make it there. I'm not sure I would have.
I was going to say, there's your first mistake, is loving cricket. Like, talk about
that
what...
That was a great blessing, I tell you what.
It's like watching paint dry, that game.
Well, I tell you what, at least you don't watch people slugfesting in the corner and getting a thrill out of that. So each sport has its barns to clean, I'm afraid.
I always said that cricket needed someone like a Happy Gilmore out there, just some nutcase who, I don't know, started fights with people.
I'm trying to remember. I was just reading one of the American comedians some time ago was taken to see a cricket match, and halfway through he said, "When does the game begin?"
Yep.
Something like that.
When I was...
It's a great sport once you understand it, but you're right.
Yeah.
Too complex to explain without watching it at the same time.
No. Well, I went to one match. I lived in Australia up in the Blue Mountains for 5 years.
Uh-huh.
And they kept begging me to go to a cricket game. So finally somebody took me to a one-dayer, which is all I could handle. I mean, a test, there's no way, right? So the best thing about the cricket game was actually watching the crowd, how many fights there were and the drunken palms. I mean, it was just incredible.
You know, and this big money has brought that reality about. I mean, it's strange as it may seem, a little bit like the World Cup of football, you know, or soccer. You just see things going on in the stands, and you wonder whether people have lost their capacity to think. At the end of an India-Pakistan series, it's not uncommon for somebody to jump off a high balcony somewhere because his team lost. Big money has come into it, and a lot of spectator interest in it now. It's changed. Yeah, it used to be what you call five-day test matches, then to one day, and now they have even what they call 2020s, which is a 3 to 3.5 hour match, and all dictated by television and our decreasing capacity to concentrate.
I'm sorry, our decreasing capacity to what?
To concentrate.
Sorry.
You know, we want all kinds of situations solved in 30 minutes or 1 hour or 2.5 hours. Although I have to say this, you know, you watch I'm not a golfer, but that can go on for a week and people don't complain, so it all depends on how one understands the sports and the skills involved. For those who play and love cricket, there's no game on earth like it. For those who don't, they just marvel at how any team can score. You know, I was telling my son, I went to see the Braves play this week, and living here in Atlanta, and I don't know how many balls they go through in each inning, 7 or 8, and in cricket, each ball is used for 200 runs. Of course, a different way of scoring, because the shine on the ball is needed to swing it in the air, to move it in the air, and so on. And so between the basemen, as we call them, and the spinners, the shine has one use, and the worn-out exterior has another use. Very complex game, but isn't it interesting?
There's some spiritual analogies there, Ravi.
We sure do, and we borrow from it, too. You know, we use things like, boy, I was stumped by the question.
Yes.
That's a cricket metaphor.
Yeah.
You talk about being somebody not being fair, and you say that's not cricket. You talk about a sticky wicket. These are all right out of cricket.
Man. You know, when I get to heaven, first thing I'm going to scream out is, how's that?
There you go. Yeah. There you go.
All right, listen, let's get... How did we get on to that? My goodness. You left India by the age of 20. 1963, you decided to buy into the Jesus stuff. How old were you in 63?
17.
So a teenager decides to follow Christ because life is not going well and father got stuck up his grill. You know, I mean, your dad got stuck in India, and for good reason. You were just waffling about.
Right. Very indisciplined. It's hard for me to even imagine those years. And as hard as it may sound, you know, you come from a culture there where you're often shamed into reality. And my dad, when he was hard on me, I really hold nothing against my father whatsoever. I don't have a moment of ill will or ill feeling. I've lost my dad now. He's buried in Toronto. And
with your mother?
My mother, too. Yes, yeah. Both buried in Toronto. And he became a wonderful person even after he became a follower of Jesus Christ. But yes, at the age of 17, I wanted to throw in the towel. All of my buddies were doing very well. I was the only thing predictable about my exams each was how terribly I would fail in which subject. That's not exaggerated. It's not overstated. That's exactly the way my life was. It was until Christ got a hold of me and his message, and that was 47 years ago. I'm 64 now.
Wow.
It was the greatest decision, the greatest commitment, the ultimate paradigm shift for me. Never regretted one moment what happened then, and I've lived life to the fullest since.
Ravi, have you ever gone through the dark night of the soul like Mother Teresa? Have you ever had a season of doubt?
Not in my personal faith, never, because I think to me what happened in that moment, Drew, was so thorough and so complete that I was I have no doubt of my conversion story. But have I gone through dark nights of the soul? Yes. I think when our children went through some tough times and children went through some dark valleys of their own. Nothing grieves the heart of a father or mother more when they see their children going through. Thankfully, they came through it. But while they were going through it, you really are on your knees asking God for wisdom and some light to shine on it that time.
You know, I love how you communicate and how clear you are, and you're a brilliant thinker and a brilliant communicator. But the problem I have is that until I know someone's gone through some dark night of the soul stuff or some serious doubt, or that they don't see doubt as necessarily incompatible with faith, I tend to lend my ear to those who have wandered spiritually a little bit, and they've experienced the busy signal like I have when I've called God countless times.
I think it is normal, and I fully sympathize with what you're saying. When I'm thinking here of doubt, my doubt has never been, Drew, in God's blessing on my life and his calling and claim upon my life. I have often struggled or faltered in terms of the process that he is taking me through. This is a testimony to what I was before. My life was literally like a leaf blown about in the wind, and I never want that past life again. And then when I see people going through struggles and pain, and when my children went through it, I always wondered what God was doing and in their lives and in mine. Did I ever come to a point of struggling in my belief about him? To me, that has never happened, because I have weighed out carefully in my own heart what this world would be like to define everything without him. You know, as G.K. Chesterton said, God is like the sun. You cannot look at it, but without it, you cannot look at anything else. Have I gone through some dry moments spiritually? Have I gone through, you know, I live with an awful lot of back problems, Drew, tremendous amount of back problems.
I'm sorry.
It's the first thought in the morning. It's the last thought at night. I've had two major surgeries. I've got 8 inches of metal each side of my spine straddling me from mid-back to lower back. When I get up with pain or walk around with pain and my eyes all tear up, I wonder what God's purpose is for me in this calling. Do I ever doubt that he is and that he has saved me from myself? The answer to that would be no. As I meet people in their struggles and in their falterings, yes, I wonder why sometimes, as one young man said to me, he said, I have only one question for God. Why have you made it so difficult to believe in you? And for some, as I have encountered, I have seen that, and my heart is heavy when I see that kind of situation.
Okay, has Ravi Zacharias ever believed in something which he no longer believes in?
I would probably say my theological positions are sort of fine-tuned when you're in your study days. You tend to lock yourself into a box of some theological historian, be it Calvin or Luther or Zwingli or the Arminian position or whatever. You lock yourself in. And the older you get, you learn to give a little ground to somebody who's of a different perspective in that. That is one thing that I've obviously surrendered a lot of ground in. Another one is that, you know, if you love your family and you do everything that you know is your best, therefore you have done that which is right. Life is not as simple as that. You can make some honest blunders along the way. And one of the things that the most difficult change to which I have had to come, if I had to live my calling all over again, Drew, I would do it very, very differently. I regret the years I traveled so much when my children were so young. And those years are lost. You don't get them back. I'm so grateful to the Lord that they're all doing well. In fact, even as I'm speaking to you now, they are in our home visiting us because it's my wife's 60th birthday this week, and they've all flown in to celebrate it. Wonderful kids, all walking with the Lord, but no credit to myself.
Wow.
So I have changed my position in terms of how to honor the call, even in the ministry. You can compromise and sacrifice other priorities, all in the name of supposedly the service of God.
You've just won my appreciation so much. I really don't know that much about you personally. Of course, I know this apologetics-type ministry that you do and how you communicate, and I've heard different arguments that you've been part of. But to hear you say that, thank you. Thanks for saying that. That means a lot.
I feel it very deeply.
Yeah.
And it's real.
Yeah. Have you ever been proven wrong?
Yes, and in terms of choices you made and approaches you took, you say to yourself, I'm not sure that's the line of argument that I would take. In terms of decisions that I made, I wished I had made them differently.
No, but as far as the apologetic stuff, let's say you and a panel of different religious leaders were sitting there, has anyone just sort of got you?
I'm sure that day will come, because I'm sure that day will come, but I'll tell you what, being a student of world religions, knowing that the gaps in the other worldviews are so huge, whether it's the worldview of naturalism or the worldview of pantheism or some other major religious worldview, I look at it this way. The four questions of life, you've probably heard that in some of my material: origin, meaning, morality, and destiny. Those four questions. In the Judeo-Christian worldview, the answers that Christ gives to me till this very day, I believe, are the most corresponding to reality and most coherent as a whole. Sometimes in an approach to an argument, you may falter, but the argument that you're trying to make and the view you're trying to defend, I, to this point, have not been on a panel or on a discussion where somebody... Now, you may get something like this if someone says, what is the ultimate problem? And you, without thinking, you use the word sin, which is not a very happy word in a secular setting, and the gotcha feeling for them comes, that we knew you were one of those. Those kinds of choice of words and so on, I will just use instead words like evil, and they will ask me to define it, and I'll say, I'll be happy to define it if you will too. And you come to a very sober realization that 2,000 years ago, as the gospel was presented and written out, it stands the test of time. One day, I'm sure some superior philosopher might find some kind of a logical flaw in the argument. I don't think that'll change the conclusions I've come to, because no worldview depends on one single knockout argument.
Well said. Again, on the line with Dr. Ravi Zacharias. I had a lovely chat with my friend Paul Young a few days ago. He said hello.
Yeah. Great. How's he doing?
He's doing quite well. I actually said to him, Ravi's coming on the show this weekend. He said, oh, good old boy. I love him. Paul, he loves,
He's a terrific guy. We had a meal together. I love Paul very much.
Yeah, yeah. He's a hugger. He hugs everything that moves.
Well, his life has come through again, twists and turns, and he represents his faith in a very warm and affectionate way.
You weren't a big fan of the shack, and I remember seeing a YouTube clip where you and a few others maybe spoke out about it. Do you still feel very disappointed or challenged by that book at all?
Yeah, I'm not sure I did anything on the YouTube with that. It may have been, I know Michael Youssef, who's a pastor out of here, he spoke out very strongly. So let me give you a bit of a context in this. First of all, because I know who Paul is, and I know what he stands for, and I know what he's representing, it's not a book that I would tell anybody, I find too many flaws in it. I think my own children have been so warmly blessed by it, and many I know all over the world. And what I said to Paul when we met is, Paul, it's not written for me. You're not writing this book for me. And so for me to like it or not like it is really immaterial. I don't let my imagination unveil certain mysteries to a point where that which was intended as a mystery is suddenly denuded. I like more the allegorical approach that Lewis makes, where the mystery continues to remain. I think The Shack is a powerful book. I think it is a meaningful book. It has addressed a lot of people's needs. It's not a book for me. And I don't see God in those kinds of images, but he didn't write it for me, and so he can draw comfort from that. I know my books too. Somebody would say it's so esoteric and so abstract, it doesn't connect with me at all, and I say, thank God there are those who will. And I'm reaching people at a different level. So Paul's life is a wonderful life, and he's touching tens of thousands of lives. In my genre of reading, it was not one of those books that really I would see in the same way as tens of thousands.
No, that makes sense. Ravi, have you actually sat down and had tea with someone like a Dawkins or Hitchens?
No, not Dawkins or Hitchens. And I have Dawkins went after me and started to make all kinds of allegations about me that were not true. I just smiled about it. I made a couple of quotations from him, which he liked to deny and dance around. And fortunately, I have the newspaper articles to prove exactly what I had said that he said. And he tried to sort of soft pedal all of that. Dawkins comes through as a very angry man. And if I did do a conversation, I'd rather do it with Hitchens. I think he comes through as more authentic. Dawkins comes through as somebody with so much of pent-up hatred inside that I'm not sure you could ever debate reasonably with Richard Dawkins.
Right. What would you say would be the difference between a good apologist and a bad apologist? How would you concisely wrap that up?
A good apologist, let me start with a bad one. A bad apologist focuses on the arguments. A good apologist focuses on the questioner. I think a good apologist is not trying to just respond to the question. He or she is responding to the questioner.
That's like Christ.
And, yeah, that's right. Exactly, Drew. If you don't get through to the questioner, what is the point answering the question? Because it doesn't really, in the end, reach. You have to see the assumptions of the questioner. You have to understand the hurts of the questioner. You have to treat them with dignity and respect. If you're trying to vanquish the person, my mother used to have a simple proverb. She said, once you've cut off a person's nose, there's no point giving them a rose to smell. Bad apologists cut off the nose. Good apologists keep the nose intact and let the sweet savor of Christ be then the aroma that is given to them.
You know, you were in your 20s when your mother passed away. How old were you when your father passed?
5 years after that. I was 28 when my mother died, and I was 33 when my father died, both buried in the western part of Toronto there.
Probably a brutally unfair question, but I'll ask it anyway. Whose death impacted you more?
Well, it's easy to answer that. If my father were around, he'd know why, because if it weren't for my mother, I wouldn't have made it. She was the only one who sort of sustained me in the years where everyone else had given up on me. My mother was a teacher. Till this day, the things that she taught me, she was a teacher in physiology and hygiene. I still remember she went with me to register in university. She went with me through my exams and all of that, helped me prepare. So the loss of my mother was huge. Life changed drastically. Over the years, as I think back, having lost my dad, I feel his loss very, very deeply, deeply than I think in the initial impact of that time. You're in India, in the Indian culture, you're close, but it's not the same as you are in a Western culture. The number of times my dad hugged me, I could probably count in one hand. The first time I remember him hugging me was after my mother passed away.
Wow.
He may have hugged me when I left India. When I was 20. I can't remember that. And to hear them saying "I love you," it's not exactly a culturally comfortable point. They do it more by actions and demonstration. The immediacy of my mother's loss was huge. Over the years, I have felt the loss deeply of both of them.
Wow. I guess the cultural differences are ones that we'll just never really understand. I mean, for your father to not have hugged you, as you said, he might have, but you don't remember, until after your mother's death?
Yeah. You know, my brother-in-law, Sundarkrishnan, who's a pastor there in Toronto.
Great pastor, by the way. Yeah, good teacher.
Great fellow. And Sundar and I have known each other from when we were 5 or 6 years old. Sundar will tell you that his father didn't tell his mother that he loved her until he was on his deathbed after 60-some years of marriage.
Wow.
It's a very strange thing, very hard for people to comprehend now. You know, it's a little bit like Fiddler on the Roof, you remember?
Mm.
Goldie, do you love me? You know, for 25 years I've done this and done that. I know, but do you love me? That's exactly an Easterner sits there grinning from ear to ear and saying, I know whereof thou speakest. That's the way it is, but it doesn't mean that it is not done. It's just communicated in different ways.
Well, Rabbi Zacharias is who's on the phone. We're just about ready to say goodbye. A couple of quick things I want to bring up. Well, maybe one not so quick, but we'll see how it goes. Well done at the Mormon Temple, by the way.
Thanks, Drew. Much appreciated. It was a tough, tough decision. Thank you so much for those thoughts. I really appreciate it. It is not easy to have said yes, and I took a lot of flack for it, but if they asked me again, I'd be delighted to go.
Well, I've heard from both sides, from the upper echelon over here in the Jesus world and from the Mormon folks as well. Both camps were very appreciative, and our heads can be held high because of how you represented the Christian faith.
Thank you, sir. And I enjoyed being with their faculty at Brigham Young the day before, too. They were very kind and hospitable and allowed me to. And their religion faculty was on the platform the day I delivered the talk. It was a real honor.
I've been trying to think of the name of the gentleman, I guess one of their premier scholars, who Jim Beverly hooked me up with, who spoke very highly of your talk there.
Bob, my goodness.
Robert,
Bob, he was in my office.
It'll come.
Yeah, Greg Johnson brought him along, and he was the one.
Milner. Was it Milner?
Yes, sir, I think so.
Yeah.
I think it was something like that.
Something like that. No, he was, well, and I thoroughly enjoyed the discussion on this show with him, so.
Did you really?
Great. Oh, it was great. It was good to have him.
Amazing the answers he actually gives to some of the questions, and he was very, very cordial, and when I told him I would come on the condition I could select my subject and the music, it caught him off guard for a moment, but then he got back to me and said, so be it.
All right, the final thing I want to talk about is me. Do you have a moment?
Sure, sir. happy to do it.
Happy to talk about me. 30 years following Christ, or attempting to, pathetically to. Mike Iaconelli uses a story which is accurately describes my faith journey. Following Christ and all of his gang of people that he's associating with, and all of a sudden he stops and turns around and looks in my direction and says, you, come here. And I'd say to myself, me? Really? Wow, that's incredible. My move forward, he says, no, sorry, not you. The guy behind you is who I was talking to. That's the spiritual awkwardness I've felt for about 30 years. I'm now at the point where I know new terms have been thrown around, terms that normally wouldn't mesh with each other, such as a Christian agnostic. Ravi, I'm as close as I've ever been to throwing it all out the window. Where I land on might be Pascal's wager. And that's, in my state of mind, I still think that's kind of a pathetic place to stand. It shows you my faith is a mile wide and a nickel deep.
Boy, I'd love to sit down and talk with you, Drew. Thanks for your candor. I really respect your candor. And obviously, you're a man greatly gifted with both insight and experience and also with language. I would love to sit down and talk to you, and I'll tell you why, because I think the greatest instruments are those who came closest to abandoning it all. Peter is a great example of that. Paul is a great example of that. And if you go through the life of almost any great personage in history, they came to that point of just wondering whether it was all going to be worth it. Was Adoniram Judson a classic example of that? And yet became probably one of the greatest missionaries ever, and then translated the Bible into Burmese. His wife translated the Bible into Thai. This kind of twisting, turning, Pilgrim's Progress is not atypical of greatness. And I think whatever God has in mind for you, Drew, I believe it could be something great. Hang on to the slender thread that you have, because I think he will grab your wrist and use you mightily. Don't throw it. C.S. Lewis says, when you feel like coming to that point of throwing it all away, don't. He said, just take one step back, not 10 steps back. And whatever brought you as a series of events to that point, maybe just a step or two back, Drew. And I tell you what, I'm coming there in September. I would be honored to sit down and have a lunch with you, and let's just talk.
Well, thank you. I appreciate all the kind words. I mean, I share that with you not for sympathy or to soak any more of your time, because you're probably one of the most overbooked guys on the planet. But I tell you that because I know that there are many out there who have listened to my show over the last 7 years who understand the journey I've been on, because they're on a similar journey, and they sit there and they wonder about the emptiness of the other side. They, you know, the one-sided relationship, the footprints in the sand scenario, and they really don't, you know, they come to that point where they say, really? I mean, come on. Really? There really is a God? How has he shown up? Well, he's shown up with these sorts of blessings. Well, I could have been blessed like that if I wasn't following him. The rain falls upon the just and the unjust. You know, yes. So these sorts of arguments come along, and it's not as though Christianity has failed me, as you've, of course, that book you wrote, brilliant book. Christianity has failed everybody, I think, but it's just the actual reality of a creator.
Yes, and yeah, you're right. The book that has just been released, Has Christianity Failed You? I did an interview with Fox on that yesterday. There are many. The number is legion. But, you know, Drew, I crisscross this globe, and I meet some of the finest followers of Christ. I was in China some time ago, and we'll be speaking to pastors of home churches. I won't say much more than that, in a setting which will be representing over 60 million Chinese believers. I sit down around a room, and I watch and listen to their stories. And it is so overwhelming. You feel you just don't want to take away the sacredness of what God has done. The stories that come out of these countries where God was evicted, you see God moving in so many different ways. And in your own life, even though it may seem like that, somehow I feel in the West we have become pragmatic in material ways and not as pragmatic in the right sense of the romantic and the emotional ways. I think God, when he describes himself in the epithet of love, ought to be taken seriously. We think much more of the issues of truth and revelation and all. I think knowing the love of God personally is a very difficult challenge, but once one experiences that day by day in the inner life, no matter what arguments come your way, you know you've met with him that day. I will promise to be praying for you, as I know you will be praying for me.
No, I won't be praying for you.
I think you should. I need it, because I need people to be praying for me.
I don't think you want my prayers.
Well, I'll tell you what. All prayers will help for me, because I get into very, very tricky situations. And when I get out of there, I say to myself, how did this ever happen? And I know it is because somebody somewhere uttered a prayer. I get letters from people whom I never ever thought. I could tell you a story right now that would take 5 to 6 minutes, but I won't. My book is dedicated to a businessman in China who told me, who didn't believe in prayer, who didn't believe in Christianity, considered the whole thing rubbish. And if I told you the transformation that came into his life, and the man is a tycoon, and he told me of the hypocrisy that he saw and the distantness of God and so on. Now, I get letters from him, I get an email from him at least 4 or 5 times a week, and he just told me he's overwhelmed by the fact that I dedicated this book to him. And he said, I'm not a reader, but this one book I am going to read. He assured me that prayer was not a part of his life and belief was not part of his life. Today he's one of my closest friends and a very devout follower of Christ. So maybe even if you wouldn't mutter a prayer for me, I'm sure somebody listening there might be praying that one day Drew will pray for Robbie, and that'll be great.
Well, listen, my cell phone is sitting here beside me, and it's been going crazy. I think I've shocked more than a few people who are listening to the show who know my cell phone number by coming out with this revelation. But, you know, it's just one of those things where you do what you do, and nobody does it with more clarity than you, Robbie. Nobody does it with more clarity than you, more reason, more basis in truth. I get that. But at the same time, you know, I find myself in this position, and I'm thankful that you do what you do. I've heard nothing but brilliant things about you. Thank you for not, and I can hear you already deflecting the compliment to God, and, you know, but by the grace of God, go I. But, you know, it's nice to be able to point to someone like you, a man of integrity, who's not been embroiled in any controversy, who has no airs of arrogance, who could have the right to such, I guess, a level of pride, but yet walks in humility. So that was my long way of sucking up to Ravi Zacharias there at the end there.
Well, you're very kind. If I can just say two quick things to that. My son, Nathan, went through a struggle of his faith in the last year at university. And I remember praying for him so much and even flying down to Indianapolis and staying in a little motel, a little strip motel there within 5 minutes' drive of his college. And we would meet for dinner every night. He went through that dark night of the soul. I'll never forget the day he made his return. He left a letter on my pillow, and he said, "Dearest Mom and Dad, you're right, and I'm wrong. Forgive me. I've tried it. There's nothing out there. Nothing. In big, bold letters, God is all I really need." And he made his journey back to Christ. Today he is a writer, and I think will turn out to be extremely a good one.
Wow.
Douglas Coupland, whom I'm sure you know,
yes.
the Canadian writer, Life After God, closing the whole book by saying, "Now sit down while I want to talk to you and tell you, here is my secret. I need God. I need God. Without him, I cannot love. Without him, I cannot be kind." And he went on to describe several things. And the last thing I want to say is the description that Chuck Templeton gave to Lee Strobel when Lee asked him, "Where is Jesus in your life now?" And he said, "I miss him." And, Drew, I'm not going to give up hope on that. I think you're too honest and straightforward a guy. God will meet you in the place that you will not be able to deny him, and will meet you in your greatest need, and that'll be my hope and prayer. And I'm serious. Let's just grab a... If you like Indian food, I'll take you to one of the nicest Indian restaurants in the West End there. Let's grab a cup of coffee. Let's keep in touch, Drew.
Yeah.
I'd love to sit down and chat with you. Not for any other reason, but just... Your struggle is that honest... I'd love to be a friend to you through that.
Well, thanks, mate. I appreciate it. But you're packing, and you need to go. And I have appreciated having you on the show. You're a gentleman I've wanted to have on for a number of years. We're coming into our eighth season. I think I originally asked about around season two. So for you to slow down enough to join us, I'm very thankful.
Bless you, my friend, and your family. Thank you very much for having me. It's an honor.
Thanks, mate. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Ravi Zacharias on The Drew Marshall Show. And, I've got about 36 text messages to wade through. Oh, boy. Okay. But we do have a show to keep going on with. And I could process my baggage somewhere else some other time. Jim Henderson is joining us. Author of Outsider Interviews, A New Generation Speaks Out on Christianity. And then in the studio with Dr. Susan Bialy. Lots coming up. And we'll lighten it up at the end of the show as well, folks. You're listening to The Drew Marshall Show.
The best map will not guide you. You can't see what's round the bend. Sometimes the road leads through dark places. Sometimes the darkness is your friend. Today these eyes scan down land for the coming of the outbound stage. Pacing the cage.
Like what you've heard? Listen again online at drewmarshall.ca.
He's been a guest on CBC's Test the Nation and the Global Comedy Fest in Vancouver.
He's the first Christian radio host invited to speak at the Canadian Association of Broadcasters annual conference.
He's an improv and stand-up comedy student at Second City in Toronto.
He paid an atheist and a pagan to go to church.
And he's known simply as The God Guy on Q107 in Calgary.
After more than 7 years, Drew Marshall is known as the Howard Stern of Christian radio because of his brutal honesty and the fact that he'll interview people others won't.
Like the high priest of the Church of Satan or the leader of Canada's polygamous colony.
He's also interviewed everyone from blues icon B.B. King to television icon Kathy Lee Gifford, from shock rocker Alice Cooper to the godfather of soul James Brown.
And two of Canada's most recognized faces, Don Cherry and Stephen Harper.
Unpredictable.
Provocative.
Genuine.
To book Drew Marshall as a guest speaker or master of ceremonies, go to drewmarshall.ca.